We were talking about first impressions of John Hanna and President when the tape ended, going back to some of his style as President in the early years when you first got here. There was a you were mentioning his maybe the direct personal interest that he took in faculty.
Yes, he did. And if it's not that he kept up with you. But he did have that opening reception where he greeted each person. And I know that in the early days when some of the faculty that he wanted to keep, as I said earlier, he was building a new faculty in a new university. And so he was gathering people from faculty from all over the country, from all, he loved to get people from Ivy schools, and from the East and West Coast, etc. And he wanted to retain these people. Very often, some of them would get a good job off and want to leave. And he would very often personally, and this is hearsay, take them up to his office and say, now you want to stay here. He would personally try to convince them to stay and share with them, I think, his vision of Michigan State becoming a great university, abandoning that cow college image. So in that sense, but he was a very, well, I hate to say dictatorial, but he was an autocrat. Mm-hmm. He had a vision and he was out to realize it. And on the one hand, he didn't see a strong faculty having a say in the running of the university is the way to achieve his goals, mm-hmm. I think.
So faculty were somewhat out under his administration. They were cut out of the governance, or
well,
it was limited?
Very, very limited. Mm-hmm. Very, very limited. And the 60s brought about that change, mm-hmm. those changes. And that's something he couldn't handle. Mm-hmm. When the students and the faculty became more rambunctious, it was very difficult for him. And that's why he really retired precipitously, mm-hmm. without any provision for his replacement. Mm-hmm. And so it was because the times had changed. Mm-hmm. But during his time, he was able to create go a long way towards fulfilling his vision for Michigan State. He did wonders for Michigan State. He was a remarkable person to have had in office. The university was very, very lucky. Mm-hmm. But he was a man of those times. He mm-hmm. couldn't deal with the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he, I remember the faculty used to call him Uncle John. Behind his back. Uncle John, he was always referred to
as. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit later about your husband's experience, but Dr. Wharton, if we jump ahead, obviously, mm-hmm. a few years, mm-hmm. When you first met the Whartons, what impressions
that
you remember?
Well, they seemed mm-hmm. to be a delightful couple. Mm-hmm. They were very cultivated, both of them. They were very much Easterners, both of them. They brought a certain, refinement, a certain sense of gentility to the campus. They were, that was what I think of in terms of the Whartons.
Mm-hmm. And any differences in administrative style that you saw? In either approach to teaching or
the
university?
I was, like most faculty, pretty much removed from the president and an administrative style. I mean, if someone were to ask you about all the presidents under you who were president, most of the time you're not even aware of what's going on. I think that the Wharton was a more, I don't think he had the kinds of dreams from Michigan State University that Hanna had. He wasn't propelled by this desire to build a great university. He was there, I believe, he saw himself as administrating a going concern and to do it as well as he could in a very, I keep using the word refined, that's the way I think of him. Mm-hmm. I think of him, a cultured person. And
You had social contact with many of the presidents,
yes,
of course, in that time. Were there any special occasions that were almost always where all the presidents were brought together, or that you
yes,
recall?
Occasionally that would happen. For instance, when I think it was DiBiagio who wanted to have the boardroom up on the fourth floor of the Hanna administration building to have portraits of all the presidents. And at that point, DiBiagio had hired someone, a firm, really, to do these portraits. And it was done with photographs that they then did something with that made it look as if it were a painted portrait, but it really wasn't. Mm-hmm. And at that time, all the presidents were brought together for that purpose, and that was done. And at various affairs, for instance, when John Hanna died, I remember Wharton came back to attend the memorial service, and we saw them then. And we would occasionally run into them, because, you know, Wharton was an economist. And as several of the presidents were, as it turned out.
Cecil Mackey.
Cecil Mackey. And so that at economics meetings, I would sometimes see Wharton.
I see.
Yeah.
In
after he left here.
Mm-hmm. In looking at any of the provosts and some of the other people that, and maybe the board of trustees, that were there any that you recall in your experience or in your husband's experience, that any board of trustees members that you think might be good interviews, or that are still living, that might be a good interview appropriate?
One person I remember that you may want to think about interviewing is Blanche Martin.
Okay.
Because he lives in the area, mm-hmm, he's still alive, mm-hmm, and he was on the board when all the student activities took place, mm-hmm, and so he would have a very clear view of it. You may, if you could, interview Larry Owen, who was chair. What was his name? Who he was with the, what foundation was he a member of?
Russ Mulvey?
Yes, okay. You may want to interview him. Mm-hmm. Because
he was chair for quite a few years.
He was, and he was a person of substance and devotion to the university, and you might, because he may be getting along in years, so you should put him on the top of the list. I have no idea about the state of his health, but
if we could talk a little bit about your husband's career, AIR at Michigan State, and his decision to come to MSU, did he have several choices, or was this...
Two choices. One was at LSU in Louisiana and Michigan State, mm-hmm, at that time. And we just chose Michigan State for some reason, I guess, whatever. We didn't think in terms of LSU. So we came here thinking, like everyone else in those Cherry Lane brick apartments, oh, we'll be here for a year or two and then we'll take off. We're not going to stay here. I mean, it was. So we came. When Walter got the job and he told his fellow graduate students at Yale that we were going to, they said, oh, you'll love Ann Arbor. It's a very interesting place. Well, they never heard of East Lansing. They didn't ever hear of Michigan State College.
Mm-hmm.
Others who were a little more knowledgeable, perhaps, said, you know, it's going to be very interesting. People will bring you, farm goods, they'll bring you potatoes, they'll bring you chickens, they'll bring you, etc. So the whole Eastern attitude of what is in store for us, this is what we came with. And Walter was the kind of person who was, he believed on his list of values. And one of his highest values is loyalty. And once we came here, it was clear that he developed this very strong loyalty to Michigan State. And there was it would have been almost impossible for us to leave after a while. He had some run-ins with his chairperson initially, and as a result, he was thinking of the possibility of leaving. But that was only very initially. And I got a friend of mine, a faculty person here, who's retired now, I'm not going to mention her name, who is the daughter of a faculty person at Michigan State, long time ago, who Walter knew and worked with on university-wide committees, showed me a letter that her father had sent to her. She said her father's practice was to write a weekly letter to all his children. And she said she was putting his affairs in order, and she came across this letter written in the early 1960s. And there was just three sentences devoted to Walter. He said, you know, Walter, a good guy in my estimation, really blew his top at Hannah because the faculty wasn't being informed of what was of decisions being made by the president and the upper administration, and he really blew his top. He'll have to leave. I got such a kick out of that letter. It was typically Walter, and it was a misreading on her father's part of Hannah, because Hannah would not have. Walter believed that if Hannah thought that your best interests were Michigan State, that you weren't just, you know, shooting off your mouth just because you felt like doing it. But if you're doing it in what you thought were the best interests of Michigan State, he would tolerate it. Otherwise, he wouldn't. And so, but anyway, I thought that was very amusing.
This issue of loyalty, was there any point where you knew personally that he was really committed to continuing his career here? Is there anything that stands out where you recognize that he had made
his decision? Well, he turned down a lot of offers.
He did.
Academic offers and non-academic offers. For instance, he was offered the executive, I don't know what the title is, executive secretary or president or whatever it was of the Independent Bankers Association. And I remember its headquarters was in Sauk City. And he turned that down. So he wouldn't go outside of the academic profession. He had a pretty realistic understanding of his strengths. He knew that teaching was an area of his strength. He loved teaching. And his focus in economics never varied, even though the fashions in economics changed over the years. He retained his focus. He had a strong belief that for a healthy society, you can't have concentrations of power. And this was true of economic power, which is where he focused his attention. And he always believed that economics should really be political economy, and that antitrust as a discipline in economics, of course, given his beliefs, was the area that he concentrated on. And so he knew that his strength was in writing. He was a good writer, and he was a good teacher. And it wouldn't be in administration. That's why he refused to even think of staying on in the presidency. But his loyalty to Michigan State made him agree to accepting that interim position, where the university was really in turmoil. Were you here at that time?
No, I was at Central Michigan right at that time. I began in 1968. I graduated high school. And I was
that
up
was
at,
just at the
I was
beginning
at CMU,
of that time.
Just at the beginning. And I was there. I had a low draft number. And then I got drafted at the end of 72, right at the tail end of the Vietnam War. So I wasn't familiar with what was going on here. And then I came to Michigan State in 78.
I
missed all that.
It was amazing what was going on here. Mm-hmm. And of course, Hannah resigned or retired just like that. Mm-hmm. And consequently, and Walter really felt when the Board of Trustees contacted him. Mm-hmm. And the Board of Trustees was very divided. The Democrat, it was on political lines.
Uh-huh.
It was political lines. The Democrats wanted him, and they were in the majority at that point, and the Republicans were against him. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Hannah was happy to see him named. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know he wasn't. Mm-hmm. But Walter recognized his own strengths. He knew that he wasn't an administrator and mm-hmm. cut out for administration.
Yeah.
And so, but he could operate in that tense situation of the moment. I think he did very well. But as a routine administrator, that was not his own strength. And he was lucky enough to recognize it. I was teaching full time when he was in the presidency. So I really wasn't aware of a lot of what was going on. Mm-hmm. My students never knew that I was the president's wife. Mm-hmm. They never knew that.
Mm-hmm. They didn't make that connection.
No. And Adams is such a common name, and mm-hmm. and I never said anything to indicate that I was. And
wasn't on the syllabus for the next.
Yeah, it wasn't in the syllabus, and I.
It's interesting. I know we've talked before about a little bit about his war career. And did he, at that time with you, did he talk at all about the war or?
Not that I remember.
Not so much about the Vietnam War, but I'm thinking terms of what you mentioned about he wasn't afraid of the crisis.
No, he wasn't.
I mean, he'd seen his combat experience, he'd seen other things.
Yes.
But at that time, do you recall him saying anything or making any allusions? Well,
no.
he didn't fear students, perhaps, because
no.
he'd seen
and I'll tell you something.
A real enemy.
Yeah. Well, but he didn't fear students mm-hmm. at all. He was,
at that,
and I didn't fear students either. And mm-hmm. I'll give you a little personal example. One day, I was going out of my office on second floor, in Bessie, down to my classroom, which was on the first floor in Bessie. And as I left the classroom, a colleague, that's all I'll say, a colleague said to me, "Where are you going?" I said, "I have a class." Meanwhile, there was a demonstration going on in the halls of Bessie on the first floor. And this colleague said, "You can't go down there. It's dangerous." I said, "It's not dangerous. These students are demonstrating, and they have very strong beliefs, and they're carrying on, and I know that there's a demonstration down there, but I'm not afraid of them. I'm going to class." Mm-hmm. And that colleague went back to the office and locked the door. That colleague was afraid. Mm-hmm. I never was, in part because of my background. I came from a college that was very radicalized, and I went to college from 38 to 42. It was in New York, it was in Brooklyn, New York, mm-hmm. and those students were very radical, and we had demonstrations like that all the time. We used to yell at our teachers. I mean, once the police that were outside my history classroom were lining up getting ready for what we used to call County Fair Day at Brooklyn College. They were getting ready because it's just before noon, They were under our window. Well, we were having a normal history class, American history class, with Professor Moraes, I remember. And all of a sudden, the police come charging into the room. And they said, what's going on here? Well, we didn't understand where they were coming from. I mean, this was a normal class that we were having. Of course, we drove our professor out of the profession, but anyway, he could no longer take it. But so I wasn't disturbed. But you see, someone who didn't have that experience, I could see what that person would be. Mm-hmm. So that was a funny experience.
In your husband's writings on economics, was there any book that he considered his best work that he was most proud of?
Gee, I can't answer.
Okay.
I will say that a text that he did is going into its 10th edition now, so he could consider it successful. But I think one of his earliest books, called Monopoly in America, The Government as Promoter, it was one that he was very proud of. In recent years, he felt that all his articles was not making the impact on the profession and the society that he wanted. And by this time, he was collaborating with a former student of his, James Brock, who's a professor at Miami University in Ohio. He decided that he'd take an economic topic and write it up in play format. So his last three books, the last one of which was he finished just a couple weeks before he died with Jim Brock. And they put it in play form. The whole thing is in play form. And I think he enjoyed doing it. He did three of those books. And he did a lot of writing. He was a very good writer, but it didn't come easily to him. But he took great pride in his writing style as well as.
Did he involve you at all in any editing or any testing ideas?
No. I proofread with him, okay. So I would proofread through things, and sometimes he discussed things with me, but I can't take any credit for any contributions to his work, and vice versa. He can't take any credit for any contributions to my work. Yeah.
Going back and looking at some of his, also considering some of his attitudes toward the university, the broader university, might be also his attitude towards sports.
Yes.
What was it that you saw that maybe got him interested as much in that?
He was always interested in sports. He went to Brooklyn College too. We met at Brooklyn College, even though we went to the same high school. We didn't know each other in high school. But he. At Brooklyn College, there were no sports. I mean, Brooklyn College was a whole different world from any university you might be aware of. And I think he missed that, although at that point, he was very interested in professional baseball. He knew the Dodgers, the Brooklyn Dodgers, he really was a devoted fan of and knew every player and followed, listened to every game. I mean, it was a whole way of life. When we were at Yale, we went to all the hockey games, nearly got clobbered on the head with the hockey stick of a visiting team. And the first thing he did, when we arrived in East Lansing, is to inquire where he could buy football tickets and basketball tickets. We used to go to wrestling, they used to have prize fighting here at Michigan State. We used to go to all those prize fighting bouts and take my little boy and neighbor kids, and he was always interested in sports. Winning was secondary, but he was always interested in sports, I knew.
Did you share that love of sport, or?
Well, I can't explain it. I always enjoy doing things with him. On my own initiative, no. I was, as a kid, I played a lot of street games, which we played in Brooklyn. A lot of games, like stick ball and Russian seven and stoop ball and things that I'm sure you didn't hear of in Michigan. But I always played and enjoyed being active. But I didn't pay attention to any other sports. But of course, we did things together. See, it was a different time in life, and I had a wonderful, wonderful marriage in that we were both able to pursue our own interests and yet be together a lot. It was, I can't explain it when I look back on it. It's a very interesting relationship, very, very satisfying. Mm-hmm. And I would go to a lot of sporting events just because you go, and I would be going to a football game, and I still go now. I've been to every home game this season. Mm-hmm. The crowd would fascinate me, mm-hmm. and the band would fascinate. Well, he loved the band. Mm-hmm. He just loved the band.
What did you see as maybe the early source of his interest in the band, marching band? Was it the director? Was it students? Did he have an interest in music?
I think it was the whole idea that here you have a group of young people all working together as a unit. It was that whole idea of a group working towards a common end and sort of erasing themselves as they became part of a whole. And it was that loyalty to a group and to a disciplined group and a willingness to do it, I think, that attracted him to the band. He himself was the most unmusical person you've ever met. He and this is a true story. When he was in the Army in 1943, in his Army camp, one day the post band came to play for, you know, the raising of the flag in the morning and the taking it down at night. It didn't come over a loudspeaker. There was a band there that played. And he saw a classmate of his from Brooklyn College who was in the band and had a directorial position in the band. And he said to Walter, "I can get you in the band. What instrument do you play?" Walter said, "I don't play any instrument." The guy said, "All right, I'll put you on the
cymbals.
So Walter joined the band and got him out of a lot of miserable stuff in that army post before he was sent overseas. Well, at the first time they had to play the Star Spangled Banner, he came in the wrong place with the cymbals, and the officer in charge of the post said, "Who's that cymbal player? Throw him out of the band."
Oh, no.
He said, "If only I had come in and right, I would never have gone to Europe. I could have stayed here." But
that's interesting.
That, and my son was a percussionist, uh-huh. and he was very active in the band, and he loved the band, and he was in his high school band,
uh-huh.
and we of course, as devoted parents, attended all the sessions of that high school band, mm-hmm. as well as, of course, the Spartan marching band. So, I don't know what attracted him, but he just loved the band, and he would go and listen to them practice. Mm-hmm. He marched with them, as you know. When they went to the Rose Bowl, he just loved the band.
Mm-hmm. In talking about some of the coaches, did he have any relationships with in particular that stood out that you recall? Football, basketball,
none
hockey.
That stood out. I want to say that, for instance, that was a part of his relationship that I wasn't necessarily a part of. Nick Saban, the present coach, was extremely thoughtful when Walter was very ill. I didn't know him at all. And obviously Walter didn't know him well because he came just recently and he wasn't someone from Michigan State.
Mm-hmm.
But he called, he would want to find out how Walter was, and he told me how highly he thought of Walter. Walter would go and sometimes watch the practice. Walter always stayed at the entrance to the dressing rooms when the team at the end of a game came through, he would be there and he'd congratulate all of them. Didn't matter whether they won or lost. And Nick Saban was unbelievably thoughtful when Walter was so sick and when he died. Mm-hmm. And I was very impressed with that. As you know, Walter had this relationship with Bobby Knight, which he struck up in a very odd way.
How was that?
Well, this was when Michigan State, you know, when all the basketball games were over in the old Jennison gym. And we would go to the games and with a group of friends, and we'd always sit directly behind the opponent's bench. And if you knew Jennison, did you know Jennison?
No, I didn't attend.
Oh. Well, that the bench was so close to the players' benches. I mean, where we sat was, it was closer than the end of this table. I mean, it was